Please welcome our speaker tonight, Nick from the Indian Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Nick!
That's one of them. Good evening, everybody. My name's Nick. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Nick.
I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be clean and sober. Thank you so much for the group for having me. This is actually my very first meeting where I spoke for an hour, and that was many years ago, but it's really cool. Feed First has a really, really warm place in my heart. I got sober here in Quakertown. Or I shouldn't say I did. I didn't have that power. I didn't have that choice. God saw fit, and I was placed into a recovery house here in Quakertown and found Feed First, and have been coming here pretty consistently throughout my whole sobriety. This group is just awesome, and I see a lot of familiar faces, a lot of like just love out there right now, and I'm just gonna tell you, I'm gonna speak from the heart. I all day long I'm in my head a little bit, just thinking about what I'm gonna say and try to quote the big book, and it's important for me just to speak from the heart and just talk and tell my story to the best of my ability, and just have a heartfelt conversation with you guys. How I got here. So got us all fit, April 19th, 2016, checked myself into my last rehab, thank God, at Penn Foundation. It was my fifth time there. Many other rehabs, many other detoxes, a little bit of jail, you know the deal. And something definitely felt different that time. I truly felt like I might be done. And I've had several different feelings like that, but this time, I don't know, there was a different kind of surrender that I had never had before. I actually broke down in that rehab and got honest with some different counselors in there, which I'd never did before. I started shedding some skin, and during that stay in there, the obsession of drinking drug was slowly removed, and it's a miracle because the guy, we were just talking about it before. I couldn't go 15 minutes without, waking up and just, if I even went to sleep, but, not putting something in me. And it just blows my mind that we have been able to stay sober, happily sober and content for over 6 years. But there are some things that were asked of us that we have to do in order to maintain this stuff. Stuff I was not willing to do when I was introduced to AA. In 2009, I was in my first rehab. We heard a speaker there tonight talking about doing the steps yourself. And I looked at those steps on the wall and I went, okay, one, two. And I'm like, I'm doing the steps. And I didn't know what it was all about. And I couldn't believe it. I was not sold that was your solution to my drinking and drugging problem, to my life problem. What are these steps in this book? And I remember a guy walking around who was asking, hey, you want to do a big book study later? I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I do not want to do that. You have this blue book, and you're scaring me right now. You're weird. Go away. I'm trying to talk to this girl over here. I didn't know. I didn't know what it was all about. That book saved my life. I can't believe it. I was unwilling. I was arrogant. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. I was arrogant. I was, like I said, unwilling. To even open that book up and read it. And when I did, I was so fried and so shot out that I couldn't even comprehend what they were reading. It was definitely written in a different kind of vocabulary. It's written a long time ago, and the comprehension was not there. I just thought, stop drinking and drugging, I'm good. And turns out that my problem is sobriety. I got no problem drinking and drugging. My problem is when I stop drinking and drugging. Sobriety is my problem. So, they told me to do some different things in my first rehab. Get out, get right to a meeting, say you're new, get your hand up. I was too full of fear to do that. I couldn't do that. Get honest and talk to somebody I didn't know and tell them where I was, what was going on. I could barely make it to that first meeting, and I know I didn't go. They suggested a recovery house. I wasn't doing that. I didn't know what it was, but I know I didn't like it. I'm not going there. Live with 17 guys in bunk beds. I've heard the stories. I'm going home to my parents' basement where, you know, real winners go when they're 38 years old. And they didn't know. We didn't know what we were up against. You know, this thing is so powerful. And the speaker there tonight, we had said that I wish a mother's love, a family's love, a friend's love was enough to help them get us sober, but it's just not. They don't have that power. And he also shared that it did have one power, that it stopped him from killing himself. And I can relate to that. I can associate with that. Because that had definitely crossed my mind many times. So much pain, so much just mental anguish, that war in my head that just would not stop unless I was, you know, altered in some way, drunk, high, whatever. You know, it started when I was very young. I mean, the nervousness, the anxiety, the nervousness. I had a terrible, like, nail biting problem. You know, my cousins used to call me the spaz because I'd run around like a maniac, just full of energy, wired, you know, and just nervous all the time. And I didn't know why. I was terrified of the dark, terrified of going to sleep, you know. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I remember going to kindergarten, I'm looking back, and I was terrified. Like, why? Other kids are playing and laughing, having a good time, and I'm just like, I couldn't even get out of the car. I just started breaking down in tears and begging my mom, do I have to go? Like, looking back now, like, that carried on for my whole life until I found drinking and drugging. I mean, really, it was just a matter of time. My childhood was great. There were no traumatic, you know, incidences or events that led me to pick up a bottle, pick up a bottle, you know, a drink or a drug, or, you know, it started with just some activities, sneaking out, you know, lying, learning to lie, and try to get away with it, being sneaky, being sinister, vandalism, you know, graffiti, cigarettes, you know, it starts progressing. And alcohol was present throughout my whole life. My cousins, my family, it was just there. We're German, we're Irish. It's just, it was everywhere all the time. And I wish I could say I could have been scared in sobriety. My cousins died from this stuff. My uncle, 63 years old, yellow, jaundiced, hep C, dead and bloated, basically, you know, just a walking corpse from drugs and alcohol, and it, you know, didn't deter me one bit. You know, I just kept telling myself that'll never be me, right? Until it was. And so going back, you know, they said, go out, get a home group, get a sponsor, and do the steps. I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds pretty easy, you know. But I complicate things, right? I just can't I can't stay focused. I am not good at following direction. Even in school, I just, you know, I would start out pretty good and be a strong student, sports as well, and then just fizzle out. And that's kind of what happened. I wouldn't even say happened my sobriety, because I never put any effort in at all. I would just maybe show up to a meeting, and I like to say I would show up late, you know, not talk to a single person and leave early, and then curse AA or curse whatever fellowship I was trying to go to at the time and saying, I'm not feeling any better, this is not working, without doing anything but just showing up like that, you know, maybe not making a donation, just taking your coffee, not helping clean up herself, not understanding, not hearing what was asked of me to be of service and to be, you know, really be, make recovery the most important thing in my life. And I suffered. And you know, I could say maybe I wasn't done, or I wasn't, the pain was definitely great when I first got here. I was in bad shape, in my first rehab, but you know, it just took time, you know, it just took what it took for me to get here. I don't recommend it to anybody. If you're here and you're new, please stay. You don't have to go through all that. Just ask some simple things of you. It's basically just giving yourself to AA, which completely goes about everything we think. I love that set-aside prayer. I mean, it just narrows it down, nails it. I mean, I love that prayer. If I add that to my prayer list in the morning. And she first taught me that prayer. I never heard it, and I remember reading it. Like, it was like a word that, like, just kept going and going and going. Like, anything else you want to add to this list? Like, that I need to set aside, basically everything that I think I know. My thinking mind got me here. This thinking mind cannot get me out of this thing. Although I think it will, I just need to figure things out, or, you know, I need to do things differently. Like, Why did I do things differently on my fourth rehab, my fifth rehab, you know, my sixth? Like, why? You know, and it takes what it takes, you know, when the pain becomes great enough, you surrender and you know, and I remember, I'm on my last run, you know, at the time I was not in control of my bank, my finances. I was not to be trusted with money, so my dad had basically control of all my assets, which wasn't very much. But, you know, I was already out there doing my thing and, living with my parents, and I had them hostage. My whole family, basically, you know, just manipulating them. And, we stood in the kitchen, and I said, look, I need my debit card. I gotta go through this one more time, but, I will go to rehab, in 2 days. And, it was the first time they kind of just let me go, because before they thought that, you know, if they just helped me and gave me love and gave me shelter and stuff like that. And basically it came down to them enabling me, and their friends had told them, you're basically killing your son. You don't even know it. And such a tough thing to do, to let your loved one go. And you basically give them over to God. And something was different that in my last run, I picked the phone up for once and found myself a bed in a rehab. I never did that before. It was always my sister, my mom and dad, look, we got you a bed, will you please go? You know, and I'm like, you know, it's not that bad. I'm like, you're pretty bad. You're skin and bones, and you know, you're physically addicted to many substances. And so that was one of the different things that did happen to me. I did some legwork. I actually picked the phone up and got myself a bed, but I wouldn't go right away, right? I gotta do what I gotta do. I gotta go in there lit. And it's just how it is for a guy like me. You know, I can't go in there stone cold sober, because I wasn't, first of all, and I wanted to go in there all banged up, because, you know, I just want to be, you know, who I am at the time. So I do have a home group. It's on Saturday night. It's in Doylestown. It's a one-hour speaker meeting. It's called the Conscious Contact Speaker Group. You know, and I guess I do AA alcoholically. I do have more than one home group. I belong to two different big book meetings. One is on Tuesday night. It's the sister meeting of this group, the Jaywalkers group, right here in Quakertown. Thursday night, I do a big book in Doylestown, Salem Church, another big book breakdown. And you mentioned the Indian Valley Friday nights. That's been another pretty consecutive, consistent home group for me. I try to stay active in all these groups because I never was. So every time that there's service that's available, I was willing to do that. You know, I talk to my sponsor regularly. His name is Ron. We have a good relationship, a good rapport. That's when it's, you know, good or bad, indifferent, whatever, I'm in contact with this guy. I'm not calling him when I'm, like, you know, in crisis or in jeopardy or something like that. It's a it's a relationship, and I owe it to him just to be coherent and be transparent and available and in contact with this guy, because he did make the agreement and did offer his help to me. When I asked him to be my sponsor, he said, let me see if you can help me, and I was put back a second, like, I don't get it. I thought you're supposed to be helping me, but in turn, our sponsees really do help us more than we really know. It's what it's all about. So that's a pretty cool thing. And when I did get out of my last rehab, I knew Ron, and I said, I'm gonna grab the most gung ho AA dude I know, who looks pretty happy most of the time, and is really doing this thing. He's really involved with service and which I had never had before. I had sponsors by name. So again, that was something a little bit different. And it's really cool to have that relationship with this guy. He's got a great place in my heart. Many other people know him, so he's pretty good. So yeah, I've been active in AA. You know, going back, childhood was good. You know, about ninth grade, I really started drinking regularly. I loved the effects produced by alcohol. I loved the whole scene. I loved the atmosphere. I loved what was going on, the craziness, the sneakiness, which was I already doing before. I was already into that. So the keg parties, you know, and there weren't many consequences. A couple of slaps on the wrist here and there, underage, you know, tickets here and there. And my life had no direction, meaning I graduated from high school somehow. Went to a couple classes at Bucks County Community College. Basically just went to the woods and smoked weed. I would go into the break room where they had a study hall area and just show up there and just go to sleep. You know, I was like, I couldn't do school, man. I was done with it. I was done with it in high school, but I wanted to graduate at least. And in high school, I was a pretty good student. You know, if I put my mind to it and really gave some effort, and I was a pretty good student academically and also on sports. Like I made some teams, but I would quit because, you know, I'm a strong starter, but I just fizzle out. Like I already talked about, I'm pretty flaky. And because I don't like to be directed. I don't like to be told what to do. When the coach is yelling at you to run more and do stuff and hustle, I'm like, you know, beat it, man. I don't need this. You know, I just want to have fun and played sports my whole life. I love sports, you know, all sports. And I just didn't like the strictness of organized sports. Did a lot of skiing growing up, and I was 20 years old, just working a dead end job, retail. And the opportunity came to move to a ski town in Colorado, a little place called Vail, and their motto there is "Ski hard, party harder." So I fit right in there. Moved out there, and it's a great place to really start a life. They have incredible jobs, the money, they pay more money. And they do employee housing. So a young guy who's got nothing, you know, go out there with, you know, a little bit of money, you know, a little bit of help. Wasn't money I saved up. Don't get that twisted. You know, they basically just wanted me to go because I was doing nothing with my life. And a friend of my grandfather's was doing well out there, a young girl, and I went and stayed on her couch and filled out some applications and became a ski instructor and, you know, it fit right into the scene. So for 17 years, I partied hard out there and basically just, again, I had the ski instructor opportunity and I went to snowboarding and, you know, eventually I got interested in that because I wanted to play. My dad always told me, you know, all you do is want to play, you know, you never want to do anything serious. And so working days and teaching on the mountain was not fun anymore because I was basically teaching kids and babysitting. And I moved into the hospitality industry, hotels at first and then eventually the bar, which is perfect. You know, busboy or bar back and waiter. You know, I eventually became a professional waiter working in the fine dining. And that scene was perfect for an alcoholic because the accessibility of alcohol during your shift was just what I needed. And plus, like that, you know, your fellow employees would always be able to help you out too with different kinds of supplies. And I did too. I was part of that. You know, I definitely had some part in that. But so I labeled myself as a professional waiter, and I did that at a really nice restaurant, a 4-star restaurant out there. And my life was pretty good. You know, there were some ups and downs, but the whole time I just felt I knew my life. You know, I was just so unmanageable. Everything. I could never pay my bills on time. Everything was a party. It was like always trying to play catch up. You know, I'd have like, I'd get some kind of like, you know, come up with some sort and like get things right and then just tear it all down again. And it affected every aspect of my life with finance and relationships and my family and also my sanity. I mean, I was out of my mind for that whole time there. And I tried moving back and trying to come back here again and doing the same thing, you know, and like, you know what, I belong out there, it's my home, and I'm just like on this cycle. So for 17 years I did that, and there wasn't a lot of consequence other than my progression of drinking and drugging. At one point I remember, I used to do a lot of skateboarding, we're driving to the skate park, you know, and I got the 30 pack of Pabst, you know, as I have to have. And I'm like feeling really horrible in the morning, and I'm shaking, I'm like, I cracked a beer, and I take a few drinks, and I'm like, I'm at the point now where I'm like physically dependent on alcohol, you know, and I'm there, and I'm like, wow, I've heard about this. And so in 2008, I moved back. I'm like, I'm gonna go back and really, really try back there. You know, my life was just crazy out there. I couldn't deal with it anymore. And so I'm thinking, you know, go home to mommy and daddy, you know, and start all over. tail between my legs again. I get back there, and of course, I'm going to go right to the industry that I work in. You know, I have really a lot of experience, so I move up to manager now of some pretty nice restaurants. One was right down in Philadelphia as the Phillies were in the World Series. It was Benny the Bums in the Holiday Inn down there. And I was the restaurant manager. They gave me the keys to the liquor room, and I mean, I had really had arrived now. I mean, I was doing all the food, like all the ordering, and you know, it was just it was unbelievable that they would trust a guy like me, because I'm excellent manipulator, especially in like a you know, interview setting. I look good on paper, and you know, I dress up pretty decent, and I tell them right what they need to hear, because it's what I do. You know, I did it my whole life. So they give me a chance, and for a little while it's pretty good, you know, it's pretty decent. But at some point I'm addicted to the alcohol, and then I'm physically dependent on opiates too at the time. And the accessibility there's it's just everywhere, it's just flooded at the time. And my boss calls me in the office, and he says, you know, we're gonna have to let you go. Would you consider going to rehab to get help? And I was angry. You know, how dare you, like. You know, this is what I do. You know, like the guy was trying to be nice and help me, and I took it as an insult. Like, you know, just get out of my face, like, just, you know. And so they gave me what little money was in my paycheck, because I had already stolen so much, and you know, I owed that money. You know, I barely even got a paycheck, but he felt bad, so he gave me whatever it was, squared that up, and just went on the hardest run. You know, I remember my sister invited me over for a lunch, and I show up there because I love free food, and I do love my family, you know. And there's a strange car I didn't recognize in the driveway. I'm like, okay, I think I know what's going on, but I'm like, all right, well, I'll go with it. We'll see what happens. And there's a guy in the living room, big tall guy, stands up. His name is Jay Outs. Just an awesome guy, and it was my very first intervention. And I've seen this on television. I know what's happening here. And they had their little lists, their ultimatums. I took it as an insult again. Nothing but love they were giving me, and I took it as an insult. They gave me stuff like, "We're not helping you with your car anymore." You know, my dad had co-signed with the car with me, and he was in his name. He's like, "We're not helping with that. Give us the keys. You know, if you're on our phone plan, give us the phone." And I'm like, you know, whatever at the time. And there's tears, and I'm just had this look of disgust, like, how could you do this to me, you know? After everything I've done to you. You know, and they're begging with me and pleading with me, like, can you please get help? Will you please accept help? And this guy, who's helped so many people, was there just doing what he does. And again, I took it as an insult. So for 2 or 3 days, I went and ran it hard, and I finally did agree to go to Living Grin in 2009. And I'm just a complete mess. You know, I'm going through it pretty hard in there. And my dad comes to see me, and I'm just shaking. You know, I'm a week in there, and I'm still shaking. Like, I drank and drug hard for 20 something years, and it's just all coming to an end. You know, and I'm like, I'm just feeling horrible. And he looked at me and said, "You did this to yourself." And it was true. It was very true. And I was upset when he said that, but again, looking back, there's no lying in that. And I'm looking at him and saying things like, "One and done. This is it. I never want to feel this way again," you know. Which at the time probably was not a lie. I mean, it was probably the truth. Unfortunately, like I said, people were running around that place with a big book, and it was a put off. I don't want nothing to do with that. I just gotta stop drinking and drugging. I'll be good. This is all I'm here for. Slow it down, get back to a certain point where I can, you know, control, enjoy, which I never did anyway. So I stayed the full stay there. They encouraged me to go to recovery house. I wouldn't do it. Was not having it. You know, I got out and didn't go to a meeting right away. Went and saw my friends, did what I do. Went to a couple meetings here and there. You know, they had made a list of me. I could stay at the house, but they had, like, you know, some guidelines. curfew, things like that. And I read it and chuckled to myself. I said, this won't last long. You know, I know how to manipulate these people. I did it my whole life. And it was nothing but love they were giving me, you know, giving me another chance, another opportunity. They thought maybe this was it. Maybe we'll stay. And so I got everything, you know, kind of in the wrong order. I'm thinking I gotta get a job. I gotta get my bills in order, the finances. If I just manage my life well, everything will fall into place. And they told me, make recovery the most important thing in your life. Put it ahead of everything, and everything will fall into place. I promise you this. And I was not hearing that. There's no way. That's too scary to trust that, have that blind faith in that. There's no way. So again, I get a job, you know, I'm just getting into a relationship right away, as they recommend. Real important. You know, for a few months, I take a hostage, I'm stealing from her and stealing from the family, like I do. And it's not before too long, that I'm back, and she's gone, and they're kicking me out. And I'm bouncing from couch to couch and going to my grandparents in Philly and like getting jobs out there and just a complete mess. And so that carried on for a while, a couple of rehabs here and there, Valley Forge, living in again, you know, thinking, you know, them always begging me to go. you know, at one point I'm living in Philadelphia, working in a restaurant again as a manager. Which sounds good, right? It looks good on paper. And paychecks were nice, so I could just fund myself, fund my drinking and drugging. And I'm hitting it heavy, and you know, and I live with my grandparents, and I know that she likes to save money. She did it her whole life, and she had a pretty good amount of cash. So I got the brilliant plan to steal all of her money and jump a train to Colorado. And it breaks my heart when I'm thinking about this. Like, I pack up my bags without saying a single word to them, take all the money, it's like $5,000, out of her drawer, which I was already taking from already to go do what I had to do, and leave without saying a word to anybody, you know, and jump a bus down to the train station and go to Colorado with all their money. I called my dad in Pittsburgh, and they're just like, where are you? And I'm like, Pittsburgh. Train station, and like, can you send some of the money back? You can have some of it to go, but can you have some? I'm like, no. No. You know, that's my answer. How rude. So I get out there, and I'm all banged up, you know, and my buddy lets me stay on his couch for a while, and I take time to, like, you know, go through all the pain and run out of my supplies and just go through it. I get through that. To the withdrawal, and I'm not drinking and I'm not doing anything really. And then eventually I start to feel better. So, you know, I have a job and, you know, I get right back into it. You know, I'm like, oh, everybody's going here after work. And little by slowly, I'm like, it starts with the booze. You know, it's always my first few love, the alcohol. And that sets off an allergic reaction that, I want more. I love this feeling and I want more. You know, I want the other stuff. And I'm good at finding things. One of my strong points, and it's not before too long I'm there again. I'm like, how did this happen? I know what happened in Philadelphia. I know what happened at home. I shouldn't be doing, you know, certain things, but I can't stop. Like, I just can't stop myself, and you know, I get into a crazy toxic relationship where it's just violent and stuff like that. And you know, I do some jail time, you know, we're beating each other up and the cops come, domestic violence thing, and you know, it's just ugly, you know. And so eventually, like, I bounce out of there. And meanwhile, at this time, like, the probation starts, and I'm begging, I'm like, yo, I knew AA already, and I was like, thinking if I told them that I was like an addict and stuff like that, I'd get like special privileges or some extra help, you know, like while I was on my probation, and it actually made it even stricter, which was dumb on my part. You know, I was like, don't ever tell them anything. Lie to them. Don't tell them you have a problem. You're doing it all wrong. I'm like, I don't know. I thought I was going to be able to get something out of this, you know, and so I'm doing a little bit of AA in there, but I'm not sober in any means, but I'm, you know, on paper, I have to go to meetings. I got my little list. I'm getting some paper signed, you know, just for the judge. You know, I can't wait to show him my list. But meanwhile, I'm on like prescription medication, which are narcotic, you know, but I have the legal, you know, avenue. You know, and I was trying to go to meetings. I was not doing my, I had a good sponsor. He wanted to meet up with me and do step work, and I wasn't doing that. Again, I wasn't done. I wasn't sober. You know, I was still on stuff. I kept coming hot on my test, and then, you know, and my PO kept giving me chances, more and more chances, and finally just like, we're just gonna max you out, 45 days in county, see you. I'm like, sweet, let's do this. You know, and then there the whole time, I'm like, get back with the girl, it's gonna be awesome. She's like, you're not coming back here. You just tortured, we didn't, you know, this is not happening. You're, I'm like, what? How can you do that? You know, I'm in jail. And, so I call her in Bravo, I'm like, can you put money in my books? And, you know, just sad, you know, just a sad state. And, so I get out and like, you know, I have reason now. I had things waiting for me to get, when I got out, you know, as we do. And, the thought of going to a meeting, I was going to meetings in jail because you're bored and like something to do, right? And I could AA pretty good in there. I knew a little bit of slogans and some catchy phrases and knew the readings and, you know, I was cool in the meeting, right? But I wasn't about to do that when I got out, and, it got ugly again quick, you know, and I do as we do. I pack up everything and drive straight to Kensington from Colorado. I mean, straight to Kensington. It was crazy. It was a horrible drive. I don't recommend that to anybody. But, we do what we do, right? I mean, that power was just pulling me, man. So I got there, and my dad's like, where are you at? I'm like, I went the wrong way. I'm like, making something up, you know, as we do. And, so I get back here, and I just running hard again, and I'm doing the same deal. And eventually, they throw me out, and I go stay with a friend, and he throws me out. You know, that's just ridiculous. And, I go to Penn, and, you know, I'm probably about 80% in, I would say. They were not happy back at the house, so I did agree to go to Recovery House here in Quakertown, the Hope House on 6th Street. And, so as we're signing the paper, she's like, 90 days minimum. I'm like, boom, I'm out of here in 90 days. I got it figured out. My life will be golden by then. I'm doing a little bit of AA, a lot of fellowship, not much service. Zero service, a lot of fellowship, a lot of smoky car rides and meetings, and just hanging out in rooms, drinking your coffee, maybe putting a dollar in a basket if I had it. Because I have excuses, right? Because I'm living in a recovery house, which is expensive. I don't have money to give to the program, right? I move out after 90 days. My sister takes me in because she says, you look pretty good. Got the weight up, you know, I'm working, things are looking pretty good. As soon as I get there, she's, you know, this is all love. She's like, when I'm have dinner with us, we'd love to have you. I'm like, yeah, I'll cook something. So I miss a meeting first night. And then little by little, my meetings, guys from town are calling me, guys from the recovery house are reaching out to me, and I can't even answer the phone, right? You know, I just feel so full of fear and shame. And I haven't even picked anything up yet, but like the fear is like just so overwhelming, and the shame and the guilt. Like I haven't even drank or drugged yet, but I got no God, I have no program, I have no AA, I have no fellowship, and I'm me. It's just me again. And I drift, and I'm getting resentful of my boss. You know, I'm not getting a raise, you're not paying me enough. You know, I work hard here, and I pick up. It's just what I do. I have to, you know, I have zero defense. Went on a hard, like, 3-month run. Mount Hope was that, maybe 2 months. And that's what led up to that point when my parents were like, they took me back in because my sister threw me out. She has, two young children at the time, beautiful children. And, she said, we can't have you doing these type things in our home, you know, and it's very dangerous. If they were to find them, or we don't want to find you dead. And, you know, it wasn't too long until, my parents basically had enough also. And it had to be so freeing, but so difficult for them to really just say, you gotta go, be like, we can't do this anymore. And I understand now. They thought they were signing my death warrant, you know, just turn me to the streets, but, they let me go. And, I was a grown man, sort of. And I said, I'm going to make this decision that I'm going to go to rehab, not tomorrow, not right now, but, you know, in 2 days if I'm alive. And my dad just looked at me and went in tears and said, I hope you don't die between now and then, and gave me the car keys, you know. And I went and did it, and I didn't die, and I got in there, and I got dropped off there. I didn't drive there, and have my escape vehicle waiting, which is a good idea. Not to have I've seen people doing the AMA walk on the highway, 309 with the trash bag. That's not recommended. I've seen friends doing that. I'm like, yeah, I know that guy. And that led to a whole different life. Being in so much pain and broken and really just surrendering for once, was something I never really, really truly felt in my heart. In that rehab, I stayed the course. I just said okay to anything they asked me for once. I called and asked nicely if I'd come back to that recovery house, which I never did before. They always were making those calls for me. I actually was doing some stuff in there. I did some journaling, which I never did. I got stuff on paper. I was talking with other men. I kind of steered clear of all the drama, all the chaos going on in the rehab, and really just like, because I'd been there so many times, and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I was so used to that lifestyle, like, what taper they got here, what kind of food they got there, their beds are no good here, like, I was used to that, like, being okay with that life, like, and in my head, I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. And that was I was begging God, basically, to, like, God, can you make it stop, like, I'll do whatever you tell me, like, really. And that was a different feeling I had never had before. I wrote it till the wheels fell off. I burnt myself out so hard. I was like, I think I'm truly done. And if you're there, thank God. If you're not, well, I hope you get there at some point. So I get into the recovery house. I'm just doing what they asking me. There's no more fighting. There's no more, I'm not doing my chores. I hate this place. It's too expensive. I just said, okay. My sponsor says, hey, my sponsor always says, the best thing you say is okay when someone asks you to do something, like in recovery. Simple answer, okay. And I did. And it was much easier than fighting everything. I just started going with the flow. I found a job close to the recovery house. No more, my mom and dad are picking me up and taking me to work further away. I said, you know what, I'm just going to walk to work. I'll find a job right around here. And do something different, which was cool. It was a setback, whatever. My finances, it would get caught up. They promised me if I made recovery, the most important thing, things will start to fall into place. And it's tough when you're down and out, you got nothing, you got probation and bills and fines and everything, and you're like, oh, it's so overwhelming. But, you know, this is when AA really comes in. In the beginning, they're like, you gotta find God. You know, it's all about finding God and having this faith, this armor. They can get you through anything. And the first step, you know, I thought my life was unmanageable because I drank and drug. My life was unmanageable, so I drink and drug. That was a different perspective. The insanity of step two to, like, have a sober conscious mind, semi-conscious mind to pick up a drink and a drug and make that choice after going through so much pain and suffering and make that semi-sober conscious decision to do it again. I threw myself into recovery. I could not wait for the opportunity to, like, put my name on a piece of paper and be a chairperson, which I was already chair meeting in Colorado, not sober, but I knew how to do it. And I joined a home group right across the street from the recovery house because I could walk to it. It was Thursday night. It was St. Isidore's. For years I was there. Doing what I did in the beginning was coffee. Also Percocet, the beginner's meeting, at the 8:30 on Tuesday night. I had no license, but a guy said, I'd be willing to pick you up if you want to make coffee. And I said, that'd be great. And he'd come by the recovery house, a guy named Jeff, and pick me up, come out of his way, because I was willing to do service. And at the time, my sponsor just, like, was on me. He's like, do a four-step inventory right away. We did do some book work, and we were doing big book studies at the house, so I was familiarized with the book already. And I said, I'm going to do this four step that everyone keeps talking about. Just do this thing. Get down and just take a couple, whatever it is, and write it down and do it. And he came over and we did it. And I was like, starting to feel like I was doing AA. I was doing some service. I did a little bit of step work. I took my quiet time. I did my six and seven and just prayed to God to like remove this stuff and, you know, ask my creator basically to, you know, make me be willing and be of service and be open-minded and willing. Took my quiet hour and moved forward. I kept going forward and started making amends, pretty quickly, you know, and the amends are not for me. They never were. This is all about forgiveness. Forgiving myself first and then moving forward and asking for forgiveness. And a different kind of forgiveness, not just saying I'm sorry, saying, you know, how did I hurt you? How can I make it right? Which is a different approach, which is asked of us in the big book. And nowhere in the big book does it say I'm sorry. It says, how did I harm you? How did I hurt you? How can I make this right? Something to that fashion. And not all the amends went great. Some were amazing. I mean, but the nine-step promise has slowly started coming true. As I'm doing these amends, I'm starting to be able to like it says, you go out and look the world in the eye again and be able to be okay in society, which I could never be before without being, you know, being messed up, being altered and drunk or high. like I said, the amends are not for me. I started with the hardest ones first. I went right to my parents and we're all crying together and it was just like, you know, they saw a different part of me. They saw me doing different things they had never seen before, living a different life. I'm not calling them and begging them for money and like, you know, just give them the sob story and grab my dad. They just stop grabbing. I'll give you money or you just stop. Like, I remember that one time. I just, like, enough. You're making me sick. Like, here, just go. Like, so, you know, as I moved through the steps at the time, I mean, I was praying and meditating right from the jump. This is something they taught me right away. Every day, get on your knees. Humble yourself every morning. Whatever's good for you. I like to do it in the morning. And I started meditating. That was early in recovery. This is stuff they asked me before, you know, in early. There's a little yellow card, cream card that goes around. Third step prayer, seven step prayer, nine step prayer, 10 step prayer, and 11. And I've been saying that card, for many, many years. Eventually I memorized it, if you can believe that. But I used to get those cards and just throw them in the trash or like, nah, I don't need these prayers, you know. But it's a part of my life now. And to set aside more time in the morning and you make time for God, not to make it convenient, but like I make time for God, not to find it, but like make time. It's different for me. So I get up a little earlier and I find quiet time in the morning and pray and do my thing because it's what's necessary for this mind. I have to have that solitude, not isolation, but solitude, big difference. And so I pray and meditate, not pray or meditate, pray and meditate. It's important. Or prayer and medication. as I moved forward, I remember my buddy Levi in the recovery house, he asked me to be his sponsor, and I said, let me check with my sponsor first. And he laughed and said, of course, what do you... Like, I was worried, scared, afraid to, you know, take somebody's life in my hands. I don't have that power. So I moved pretty quickly with this guy, and, it was pretty cool. The first person I did did a fifth step with, and to see the light come on in this young man's eyes and walk with him, and, unfortunately, he's not here with us anymore, but, he's somewhere safe. He's in jail, so. Pray for him daily, him and his mom. My prayer life changed completely too. It's no longer about me. I say my pretty standard prayers, and then I go to just praying for others. My list continually grows because I pray for myself my whole life, right? And look where it got me. So I continually pray for others because that's what they asked of me, and continue to try to do 12-step work the best I can. My one guy asked when I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, it'd be a privilege and an honor to be your sponsor. And I'm like, that's pretty nice. So now I try to say that to most of the guys who asked me. I said, I'd be honored for the opportunity. And I fail. You know, we don't do this perfectly. And one important thing that they talk about in the big book is it should be inconvenient. You should have to go out of your way to go and listen to a fifth step. Go out of your way to sit down and read the book with somebody when you don't want to, when you're tired, when you're you know, worked all day and you got many excuses. That's how my alcoholism resurfaces, in laziness, unwillingness, and falling short, basically, you know, the character defects, they come back. And why do I hesitate to do something that helps me so much? Because when I do 12-step work and sit down and go through a book with somebody, excuse me, I feel amazing afterwards. Why would I not do that all the time? And you feel like rejuvenated and you like learn more about the book, you learn about the guy you're working with, you start to develop a relationship, and I hesitate to do this stuff. And treatment would say, if it's working so good, why would you stop doing it? You know, and I gotta remember these things, because this is how my alcoholism resurfaces now. It's unwillingness and stubbornness and laziness, and I don't even see it, and I start to slowly drift. I drift from what's keeping me well and keeping me happy and sober, and it's subtle. It's subtle, you know. You know, if it's important, we find a way, and if it's not important, we can find an excuse, right? Find the time to help others. It's so important. I love AA. I mean, I really do. It's my life now. And my one friend says, if you give your life to AA, the sky's the limit. If you give yourself to AA, you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. These are not lies. These are not made up stories. These are true facts of AA. Most of us are living representations of that. But there is some work to be done. There is some sacrifice to be made. Again, it goes against everything that our thinking mind tells us to do. I don't even know what else I can say other than just that. I mean, most importantly, my sponsor stresses to have fun in AA. Camaraderie and laughter is very important. Not to take ourselves too seriously, the only rule in AA, rule number 62. That's a good rule. And to have fun. Because if we're not having fun, we're not going to stay here, right? Create the fellowship that you desire around you. If you're going to a meeting and it's not what you'd like it to be, try to help that meeting. Do what you can to help that meeting grow. Service and fellowship and most importantly, recovery. It's without the recovery first and the bottom foundation, we can't be of service. We can't be, you know, be in fellowship and be present and be a strong, good member of AA and a good friend and an honest person. The true blessings really are people that benefit from what we do here around us. Our family, who we destroy basically before we come here with our selfishness and self-centeredness. Because I'm only hurting myself, right? Meanwhile, I got you hostage and I'm killing you. Stealing your time, your serenity, your life. And AA gives that all back to them. So now I continue to stay and do what I do, not only for myself and for you guys, but for my family. They need me so much, and I need them. It breaks my heart that it took as long as it did for me to realize that. But they stuck with me this whole time. There were times when they had to write me off and give me that tough love. And say we can't help you anymore. But deep down inside, all they truly wanted was for me to be happy and have a good, happy life. And AA has given me that. So if you're new, please give yourself to AA. It won't let you down. You know, if it can work for a guy like me, you know, a stone cold, junkie, drunk, it can work for anybody. Throw yourself in AA, give yourself to God, give yourself to whatever you want to call it, anything but yourself, really, or that rehab romance. See if you're paying attention. And things will get better. Things will get better, I promise you this. I don't know. If anybody hasn't told you that they love you today, I do. Especially you, Mike. You guys are awesome. I hope I help somebody tonight. I know this helps me when I do this. I always get nervous, but when I get up here, it just goes away, man. And I love it. I just love being able to be of service and to be helpful in any way I can. I mean, it's truly a gift. And my sobriety is a gift, and I got to remember that every day. If I take it for granted and get complacent, a guy named Steve, who's no longer with us, would say that my disease wants me to get complacent and isolate and be alone. And then it wants you dead, basically. And gotta remember that. I gotta remember that. I don't know. It's been awesome. I love Feet First. This meeting has been a part of my life. My new life, I should say. I don't even know what else to say about it, but I'm gonna keep coming back to this meeting as long as you'll let me. And that's all I got. Thank you.